Yes, I am here for reasons.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to The Global Meltdown and The Big Picture. Cristina Figueres, Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, talks with Greg Dalton about international climate change negotiations.
Now, the United States, the contiguous country. I do believe that President Obama is personally very committed to this issue. He had a few traumatic issues that he had to deal with in his first term. And he is he's now taking difficult issues like immigration, gun control under his wing. It is my sense that President Obama will use his second term to make a very clear statement on what the United States can do on climate, and that he will do it because he personally is committed and because he knows that this is the most important legacy that he can possibly leave to future generations. But I think he will also do it because there is enough enterprise in the United States that understands that they cannot allow the leadership of the new technologies to go to China. Who is the number one country in solar today? China. Who is the number two in wind technology today? China. Now I ask you, is the United States going to stand back fully well knowing that we are moving toward a low carbon society. There is no doubt about that. We're moving too slowly, but we are moving toward a low carbon society. Is the United States just going to stand back and let China take over the technologies of the future? I can't imagine that they're going to. And there is going to be mounting pressure in the United States to move forward and actually take advantage of the opportunities of a low carbon society.
But since Copenhagen, the science has become more clear and the American political process has become more doubtful, polarized, entrenched on the question of whether it's happening, humans are causing climate disruption, and whether the solutions are affordable. So part of the U.S. is going in a different direction than what you just said, mounting pressure.
I don't think so. The polls that I see tell me that more than 70% of the United States population now understands that climate is occurring, that it does have a man-made cause, and that something needs to be done about it. Where I think there's a difference in opinion is who is going to do it, who is going to do what about it. So it's not...
And the cost,
and who's going to pay for
right.
it. That is the difference of opinion. It's no longer about the science. It's no longer about the effects on countries, even like the United States. It's about who's going to pay for it, and what are we going to do about it. There, I will agree that there is a difference of opinion.
Christiana Figueres is Executive Secretary of the UN Climate Convention. I'm Greg Dalton. Programs of this and other Climate One programs are available in the iTunes store for free. You can follow us on Twitter at Climate One. One last question, and we'll go to audience questions. Could China and the U.S., which account for about 40% of global emissions, could they cut a deal and get something really significant done to reduce carbon pollution?
Let me put it this way. There is no solution without the United States and China agreeing with each other on what they're going to do. So it is an absolutely critical but not sufficient condition. But I do take heart in the fact that just 2 to 3 days ago, I lose track of time, but 2, 3, 4 days ago, maybe not more, the United States and China announced their joint working group on climate. Why did they announce? Because both of them are individually, separately, fully aware of the negative impacts on their countries. And they understand that their economies are actually threatened by that and that they need to come together to solve this. So if there is already a working group and if there is already a very well-established conversation between Washington and Beijing, I am very hopeful that they actually will build on that to come to some agreement with each other. And then all of the other countries around the world also have to join that agreement. It's not just a bilateral deal.
But it could start there. You think about the Cold War, five or six countries had nuclear weapons, but there were several agreements from the 70s onward where the U.S. and Russia negotiated reductions in nuclear weapons and showed leadership, and then other countries may or may not have followed. But could that model follow with carbon, where U.S. and China say, we're going to do this now, all right, get in line, we're showing the way?
Yes, and that is occurring. I mean, this bilateral conversation with them is... The decision to establish a joint working group is actually the effect of a conversation that they've been having for quite a few years. But it's not the only thing that is occurring, right? There is also the conversation is also in the G20, it's in the G8, it's in the G7. It is also in something that the United States created called the MEF, which is the Major Economies Forum, which is 17, 18 countries, largest countries that make up 80 to 85% of the climate emissions. And they are also working to see how they as a group can come and can accelerate their activities on climate. And at the same time, so those are all very, very helpful. And at the same time, that is never going to be the final solution, because the Tuvalus of the world also have to have an opinion about something that directly affects them. So it is not, you know, we who were educated in the West, and I count myself to that, we think about solutions being either this or that, because that's the way we were educated. But that's not the way climate is going to be solved. It's not an either or. We have to be able to harness the contributions that everybody can make. You can have, and you have to have, small groups of countries aligned around their common interests and optimizing their particular solutions that they can offer. But that is not the full answer. Everybody else needs to come on board as well.
But it seems what's lacking is someone to go first. Everyone's waiting for someone else to do more, to take the first step. No, you go first. No, you go first. No. And everyone's waiting for someone to step forward, and no one wants to take that first step or unilaterally harm their economy or unilaterally take costly action.
That's true. And that is perhaps the greatest challenge that is there right now, right? Because everybody is functioning at their minimum. Nobody is really at their maximum yet. And what is needed is to change this you first mentality to a mentality of how are we all going to move together so that we can all benefit. But I tell you one thing, Greg, that is not unique to climate change. The fact that we are now so interconnected, the fact that we are such globalized economies means that we can no longer afford to approach global problems with solutions that are put on the table by individual countries. It is a very, very different approach that we need. We need an approach that is more collaborative than competitive. And that is the only way that we're going to be able to move forward. If we do that on climate, we will be able to do it on many other issues that we're facing. Climate, let's call it a training ground.
One that has to be trained quickly.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Good evening, and welcome to Terror School. Your usual instructor, Mr. Muller, could not be here tonight. Unfortunately, he was trying to blow up a car and burned his lips on the exhaust pipe. Normally, I would introduce myself, but in order to be able to pronounce my name, you would have to be able to swallow your own foot. So you can just call me Dude. Now, I would like to congratulate the survivors of the take-home test on poisoning. Congratulations. Thank you all for being here tonight. And now for our first lesson, terrorism on a shoestring.
Ba-boom, ba-boom, boom. Ba-boom, ba-boom, boom.
Life can be extreme, though you've ambitions to be dead extremist kooks. And if you haven't any money for some nukes, here's a little scheme to start.
Shoo-bomb, shoo-bomb, shoo-bomb.
Join Al-Qaeda's team. The folks will think that you're a suicidal freak. Just stuff your Nike sneakers with a light plastic. Boost your self-esteem, sweetheart.
Suicide.
Though it has a sulfur sting, though this bomb is crude, no one will suspect a thing. It smells like airline food. Soon you'll live a dream with 40 virgins who will meet you and you'll see. The only problem is the virgins look like me. That should make you scream, sweetheart. Shoo-bomb.
Christiana Figueres is Executive Secretary of the United Nations Climate Convention. I'm Greg Dalton. You're listening to Climate One.
I honestly don't know what else the United States is waiting for. Brazil is moving forward. Mexico is moving forward. Mexico has the most comprehensive climate legislation of any country in the world. South Africa has a price on carbon. Australia has a price on carbon. China is moving forward with all of it. What else do we need? What we need, I think, in the United States is a more orchestrated voice of, in particular, the private sector on the one hand, and civil society, the private sector, because they need to understand and more clearly voice that it is in their interest to move forward. And civil society, because civil society needs to understand that there is no other option. There is no plan B. We have to move here. We are under pressure to move, but it is actually a fantastic transformation that we are looking in the face of. So why do we not want to do that? Here's my question. Cell phones. Oh, everybody has a cell phone here, right? How big are they? About this big? 30 years ago, the first cell phone came on the market. It was called the Brick. Do you remember the Brick? It weighed 3 pounds. It only functioned for 30 minutes and then discharged. And it took 10 hours to load it. And the only thing that it could transmit was voice. Okay? Today, you're all sitting there with your cell phones that are this big, this thin, weigh, I don't know, milligrams, are, you know, charged in milliseconds and operate for hours and do everything but cook your tonight's dinner. Well, that is the kind of transformation, that transformation that we had in the telecom industry is the kind of transformation that we're going to see in the energy sector. Is that not exciting? Or are we so enamored of the darn brick that we all really want to walk around with our bricks? I mean, this thing that we have to produce energy and transmit it with wires, if that is not so 5 minutes ago, I don't know. We've got to move to another technology.
Let's have our next audience question for Christiana Figueres.
Thank you so much. This has been absolutely fascinating. Could you say a few words about Canada and how the U.S. might work with Canada to do something better than the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, the good news there is that, as you know, the governor has actually given green light for California to link with Quebec. They are going to be linking their trading systems. And that is a start, okay? It's a start at the subnational level, because we're fortunate enough to have at the subnational level a very different approach to what is currently at the national levels. But it's a start. It's a start. So how do you use that to then move beyond that and get to the same approach and the same recognition of opportunities at the national level? That's the challenge that both countries have with each other. But I have no doubt that eventually the United States and Canada will realize, just like everybody else, that A, there is no option, that this is too painful to continue to be completely anchored to our brick, and that there is huge opportunity here to be harnessed. So let's move forward.
Let's have our next audience question right here for Christiana Figueres.
Hi. Great talk. You made lots of cogent points. Really appreciate that. My question is about the various global talks that we have every 2 years and how they often fail to produce an agreement. And I was wondering if there's any way to create a rule change where global talks are tied, much like an emergency session of the Security Council, to extreme climate events, where negotiators...
Then we would have to have them every week.
Major extreme climate events, like I said.
Every month.
Where negotiators have to come into a room just when the need for some agreement is highest, both in terms of public opinion, in terms of economics, and obviously the social issues.
Well, just to assume my responsibility here in public, it is my responsibility to organize these global talks once a year. It's not even once. Once every 2 years would be, you know, wonderful, but that's not in the cards. It's every year that we put on these very, very daunting conversations, because you have to understand there are 193 countries that come together to figure out 193 countries that have at least 196 different interests. Go ahead.
But the Security Council is just 7 to 9, the top four, the top population.
And the top countries in the case of climate, it's about 17 to 18 countries that do represent the majority of the emissions, and they do come together, and they are in a very constructive conversation, okay, and they actually get together about once a month, once every 2 months. But the global talks that you're talking about, I have to disagree with you, because it is not true that they do not come to agreements. I've had the honor of leading the last three, and every single one of those came to the agreement that was on the agenda. You have to differentiate in these multilateral processes. You cannot expect any country or any participant to actually work on something that is not on the agenda, so to speak. So you came here today because there is a particular agenda. Nobody would expect all of us to work on something completely different, because we've all agreed to come here around something. And the last three conferences had very, very clear deliverables, had very clear targets, expectations, and every single one of those three were met. and we can go into the details if you want. The point is that everyone was met because we have learned from Copenhagen. We've learned how to plan these better. We've learned how to orchestrate them better. And because countries are much more determined to solve this problem. Now, the next big thing that we're going to see is the 2015 agreement, where that has to be preceded by a draft agreement that needs to be put in place by next year, by 2014. I want to really impress upon you the daunting task that governments have impressed upon themselves, because to come to an agreement about climate is nothing less than the foundation of an economic and social transformation the likes of which none of us have ever seen. It is the most daunting challenge that humanity has ever imposed upon itself. And this is done by governments, and it is done because they understand that they don't have any other options. So these yearly global talks need to be understood, each of them as being progressive steps along the way of a transformation that you will see. And you will be able to look back and go, and do you remember when we used to drive cars with fossil fuels? And you will laugh. But that transformation needs a structure, a global structure that will support that transformation. And that is what they're doing. It is no small potatoes what they're doing.
Our guest today at Climate One is Cristiana Figueres, the top UN climate negotiator. Let's have our next audience question. Yes, sir. I need to use a microphone.
An investment advisor in San Francisco wrote this brief email 2 days ago. With the overweight in oil, I got massacred yesterday. And then he wrote to my friend, his client, I believe the market sell-off was overdone yesterday. Hard to believe that a small miss in China's GNP caused such activity. Nobody seems to trust the Chinese numbers anyway. Doesn't matter. I got whacked in my oil-related holdings yesterday. Morgan Stanley and Citi Research suggest oil prices will come back in the coming months, suggesting we maintain our holdings. And my friend wrote, my upstream oil and gas master limited partnerships got killed yesterday, but I took the opportunity to buy some more Exxon. We're preaching to the choir. Where are these people?
There's still money to be made in fossil fuels, and even some people who, look, John Kerry owned oil holdings before he became Secretary of State.
Yeah, there's still money to be made in fossil fuel. And let's be realistic, okay? Even the most successful addressing of climate change does not mean that we are going to be completely free of hydrocarbons and of fossil fuels. And there are those, you know, who live in la-la land and think, okay, we're going to go solar. You know, everything is going to be solar. Well, that would be wonderful, but it's not going to happen. And the demand of energy is such that we do have to produce energy that is reliable, dependable at all times of the day and under all conditions for all people on the planet. So what that means is we will have to rely on fossil fuels for a certain segment of the energy production, and we will have to complement those in increasing fashion with renewable energy and with energy efficiency. So there is still money to be made on hydrocarbons. Would I put my money on hydrocarbons? No.
Let's have our next audience question for Cristiana Figueres. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Bora Visha. Just kind of a follow-up in the same spirit of the conversation is that you were mentioning that the issue is that the cost is going to be in the infrastructure investment that we make on high carbon technologies, for example, Keystone, right? We're not investing this now to bridge a gap. Like, once we invest in building that infrastructure, the companies involved are going to want the life of that investment to go on for another 50 years. And the amount of carbon in those tar sands just speaks to the future problems it could create by us investing in that technology, right? So I understand that, yes, we can't get rid of fossil fuels overnight, but to continue to invest in something that we might not need to and then be married to it and locked into it, you know, what about that?
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Stranded assets, right? I mean, it's a huge danger. It's a huge danger. The more we invest in these technologies that are high carbon, the more we incur the risk of stranded assets, because we will not be able, at some point, we will no longer be able to allow those technologies to live out their lifetime. So, you know, it's It's a short-term versus long-term thinking. And those who are thinking long-term would reach different decisions.
Just real quick on that. You would think that even like you said, the polls show that 70% of Americans support renewable technology, all this. And why is Obama still having trouble making a decision on investing in such?
Yeah, well, I certainly would not venture to speak for Obama. But I'm sure there are many, many different factors that he is, you know, weighing as with any important decision. So let's give him time.
Coming up next, from the movie Network, Howard Beale declaims the death of democracy.
I got up here and asked you people to stand up and fight for your heritage, and you did, and it was beautiful. 6 million telegrams were received at the White House. The Arab takeover of CCA has been stopped. The people spoke. The people won. It was a radiant eruption of democracy. But I think that was it, fellas. That sort of thing is not likely to happen again. Because at the bottom of all our terrified souls, we know that democracy is a dying giant, a sick, sick, dying, decaying political concept writhing in its final pain. I don't mean that the United States is finished as a world power. The United States is the richest, the most powerful, the most advanced country in the world, light years ahead of any other country. And I don't mean the communists are going to take over the world, because the communists are deader than we are. What is finished is the idea that this great country is dedicated to the freedom and flourishing of every individual in it. It's the individual that's finished. It's the single, solitary human being that's finished. It's every single one of you out there that's finished. Because this is no longer a nation of independent individuals. It's a nation of some 200-odd million transistorized, deodorized, whiter-than-white, steel-belted bodies, totally unnecessary as human beings, and as replaceable as piston rods.
Well, the time has come to say, is dehumanization such a bad word? Because good or bad, that's what is so. The whole world is becoming humanoid, creatures that look human but aren't. The whole world, not just us, we're just the most advanced country, so we're getting there first. The whole world's people are becoming mass-produced, programmed, numbered, insensate things.
And now for something completely different.